always something. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic, and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it to make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar. Delicious. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Be with you here until 8 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you had a nice holiday weekend. Survived it, certainly. Maybe you made it to the last of the season's farmers markets in Sebastopol. It was really a great day at the market. On one hand, I'm always really sorry and sad and sort of bittersweet. When the market ends. On the other hand, and Paula Downing, the manager, sort of said something very similar to this when I said goodbye to her. She says, I'm really glad it ends. I'm really glad I feel sad right now. It's good to feel sad and then be really happy when the market comes back. And I thought that was a really good point, and it is. You know, maybe if it went year-round, it wouldn't be such a fabulous market. So Sebastopol Farmers Market over until the first Sunday in April. But that doesn't mean there aren't farmers markets in the North Bay. There certainly are. Tonight we're going to visit one of my favorite topics, adult beverages. Not kids' drinks, not something you carry around in your water bottle if you're running or going on a bike ride or something. It's adult beverages, the kind that gets you intoxicated. And we have two people I've been wanting to talk to here on Mouthful for a long time. Scott Beattie, formerly of Osiris Restaurant, the bartender, and now a waiter at Scopa, which is just great. And also from San Francisco Magazine, Scott Hawker. Welcome to Mouthful, both of you.
Thank you.
Me and the two Scotts tonight.
That's true.
So, Scott Hawker, I want to just bring you in really first so we can sort of put you in context. You write about food and wine for San Francisco Magazine.
I
used to do.
It's true.
So just real quickly, sort of tell us.
Yeah, I'm a senior editor at the magazine. My primary beat is food and wine, but I kind of cover all kinds of topics based on what's thrown my way in the sections that I edit. But in terms of writing and paying attention coverage-wise, it's definitely food, drink, culture.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I knew you initially as someone who wrote about cocktails and spirits.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert, I wouldn't say, especially compared to the other Scott. But yeah, I do cover. Yeah, we did a big package about almost 2 years ago on the cocktail scene, just as it was beginning to really kick into gear. And Scott was one of the featured players, as he still is.
And we actually met just before Presidio Social Club, which is
yes,
a nice
exactly.
We met there as they were still getting ready to open the place. And then, Scott Beattie, you were opening bartender, right, at Cyrus?
The owners, Nick Payton and Douglas Keene, hired me out from a restaurant in St. Helena called Martini House.
Okay, yes, of course. Oh, Martini House.
Mm-hmm, one of Pat Coletto's restaurants.
Yeah, right. Well, it turns out one of the bartenders there, Pat McCormick.
McCluskey, yes.
McCluskey.
Yeah, good guy.
I went to junior high school with him.
Really?
Junior high and high school. I've not seen him there, but I heard it's like, Pat McCluskey is bartender at Martini House. I'm going to go over and see him one of these days. Yeah,
he's a good guy and great bartender.
He was a good guy then. He was one of my friends. So you have a new book out, Artisanal Cocktails. It's just out from 10 Speed Press, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I'm going to venture against a guess that this is the first book that divides cocktails by season. I don't think anyone has done that before. You can drink a martini anytime.
There is another book out right now by Bridget Albert, which also is broken down by season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's called,
I have not seen that.
Market Fresh Mixology, I believe is the name of it.
And where is she?
I think she's up in the Northwest, I think in either Oregon or Seattle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with a cocktail?
Well, I had bartended for many years in San Francisco, and excuse me. I think most bartending was sort of like pouring beers, pouring shots. You know, I was in college when I first started out. It was just sort of like a fun job. It was easy money. You know, I'm a very social person, so I think I kind of latched on to it because, you know, I was broke in college, and as soon as I got into the restaurant business, I could make a pretty good income, you know, waiting tables and tending bar.
What were you studying in college?
English, yeah. Which,
so, of course, you have to do something like get a job in the restaurant business. I was an English
major,
too. No, exactly.
No, you go to medical school, they call you doctor when you graduate. When you go to school and study English, they call you waiter when you graduate.
Exactly,
that's kind
yes.
of the way it works. But I loved bartending. I love the restaurant business. You know, I love great service. I love making, you know, interesting drinks. But I don't think I was making anything that interesting until I got up to St. Helena when I was 26 to help open up Martini House. And I was first able to, you know, go to some of the local farms and, you know, work with winter citrus and in meat distillers like the Kara Kostovich's that own Domaine Charbet, and start to work with sort of interesting seasonal produce and artisanal spirits, you know. And then Nick and Doug hired me away from Martini House in 2004 to move over to Healdsburg to sort of shape the program over there. And as you know, I mean, Northern Sonoma County is just this incredible agricultural paradise. You know, it's not just wine. It's also, you know, small dairies and, you know, little distilleries here and there and incredible
of the things,
farms.
Walking the streets of Healdsburg, there's all these unharvested citrus trees.
Yep.
It's amazing.
No, so I knocked on a few doors and left a little note and said, you know, will you trade restaurant credit for citrus? And that became part of the program. I mean, you were just talking about farmers markets closing down. I mean, you would think if you were working with seasonal produce, you know, everything would sort of shut down in November, but it actually is one of the most exciting times of year. Of the year, because, you know, you get blood oranges, Meyer lemons, Rangpur limes, key limes, like, you know, all kinds of different things that I ended up incorporating into the bar program at Cyrus.
Yeah, what I want to know is who in Sebastopol is growing bergamot?
Bergamot, I grow them.
You grow bergamot?
Yeah, I have a tree in my house.
Let's tell people what bergamot is.
Well, it's a type of orange, and it's the primary flavoring in Earl Grey tea.
Yes.
And I think it's most delicious when you just zest it over a gin martini. It's fabulous. You know, you get that real great Earl Grey smell.
Yeah, and that was probably the first varietal tea or name tea that I loved was Earl Grey. I drank it just for years.
Yep, it's delicious.
How are bergamot oranges for eating?
They're very bitter.
Very bitter.
Pretty much inedible. I think they just use the rinds.
Uh-huh.
You know, when they incorporate them in a tea or use them in cuisine, I think it's just the rinds.
Yeah. There's so many interesting citrus that, you know, are not things that we see most of the time. Do you ever work with or have you seen Buddha hands?
Yeah, I grow one of those too at my house.
Oh, you do? You grow them. So they're able to grow in Healdsburg.
Yeah, absolutely. Citrus does really, really well in Healdsburg. The thing that'll hurt citrus trees is like severe frost or sustained periods of frost, which does happen here, you know, periodically.
But only like every 12 years or so.
Yeah, I think it's like 20... Every 20 or 30 years, Bruce McConnell, who owns McConnell Chevrolet, he actually grows Meyer lemons and Satsuma mandarins, which he trades to the local restaurants. And he gave me the whole history of, like, frost in this area and said about 30 years ago, frost came in, killed just about everything.
Yeah. There was also a really bad frost, and I think it was 91, because it was about 3 months after I planted my Meyer lemons trees. They did not survive.
The young ones don't do so well. Yeah. Some of the more, you know, the older trees that have bigger trunks and...
Yeah, they have to be established.
Survive. Yeah.
So how long were you at Cyrus?
3 years. Mm-hmm. 3 years, yeah.
And you really made a name. People knew about your cocktails. You had all those bottles or jars, beautiful jars of concoctions sitting behind the bar. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, when Nick and Doug asked me to move out to this area to, like, establish the bar program, I spent, you know, months researching spirits specifically. And, you know, chose all these wonderful, you know, liquors from all over the world, and actually wrote like a 40-page spirits menu that described each and every one of them. And it had little histories on, you know, what is bourbon, what is cognac, what is Calvados, et cetera. And I had a really nice cocktail list, but I think once the place opened up and I realized that I wasn't just working at a very nice restaurant, I was going to be working at one of the best restaurants in the country, you know, with this incredible wine program and legendary service orchestrated by Nick Payton and, of course, Douglas Keene's food, I sort of, even though they weren't complaining about what I was doing, I sort of started to scrutinize myself a lot mm-hmm. more. And I got kind of paranoid and frenetic and started sourcing out, you know, all kinds of interesting, you know, ingredients to incorporate into the cocktail program. And I, you know, I just kind of lost sleep all the time, like trying to come up with new and interesting things, just trying to make what I, my contribution to that restaurant worthy of the whole experience. At the same time, people like Scott and other writers were realizing that there were bartenders out there that were starting to do more interesting things. I think for a long time, bars were sort of the neglected part of the restaurant experience.
Absolutely.
I mean, customers just essentially want their, essentially wanted their regular drink. It might be a gin and tonic. It might be a vodka martini.
And the real connoisseurs were looking at that point, I think, towards wine.
Absolutely.
And what was
absolutely.
The most esoteric wine we could find.
Yeah. And then there were some of us out there that were trying to do some more interesting things. So the press started writing about it more. Cyrus was getting a lot more recognition, and it just sort of, you know, a year and a half later, I had a book deal, and people were paying more and more attention to it. And now I don't think you can open up a great restaurant in this country, a high-profile restaurant, without having, you know, a special cocktail program.
So if you not only have a special cocktail program, you have to have a liquor license, which is, a, you know, not any restaurant.
True.
For people who are not in the business, some may not know, you know, there's a beer and wine license, and then there's a liquor license. They're
which
two different things.
Which is much more expensive, yeah.
And that used to be a real challenge in Sonoma County, say, in the late 70s and 80s, because I think even then what you were saying was true. A lot of restaurants, especially during lean times, which I think we're facing again,
a lot of
restaurants would make, people seem to like continue to drink, and a lot of restaurants would be able to survive based on their bar business rather than their restaurant business. What do you see happening, mirroring what we're talking about here in San Francisco these days?
Well, in the sense that Scott's definitely at the forefront, or back when it was, when Cyrus first opened, it fit so well into the scheme of what the restaurant itself was trying to do. You're taking extreme fine dining and really professional service, but making it accessible. And there's something about Scott's bar program that accomplished that with aplomb, because you would go, I mean, I, especially them, was much more of a neophyte. Like I said, I still don't consider myself an expert, but I kind of know from been in restaurants and been covering food and wine. So, but going in there, you always learn something, and it didn't put you off by how expansive the selection was. I mean, something like his 40-page drink menu that talks in detail about where everything's from, the sourcing, the background, the history. It invites you in as opposed to pushing you away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something huge, especially because back then cocktails, high-end cocktails were kind of not the norm, and people thought they were precious or something. And criticisms have been lobbied at Scott that his stuff is kind of overwrought, but it works, and that's the trick, just because it has lots of ingredients in it. And the end result is the taste, and if it works, that's what matters. And so similarly in San Francisco, there's all kinds of places that have really good bar programs. He's exactly right, where you can't open a place, even a neighborhood restaurant, which is what San Francisco is mostly known for in terms of styles of dining. An example that leaps to mind is Camino in Oakland. Russell Moore was a chef at Chez Panisse for, I think, 20 years, and he opened a place, and they have a bar program that's really, really shrunk down. It's very, very small, very, very hyper-focused, and Thad Vogler spearheads it. It's a really great program. I mean, a place like that, had they opened 5 years ago, would not have had a... They might have just been beer and wine.
Mm-hmm. What makes a bar program great? What is it that you look for? Is it the quality of the alcohol? Is it the creativity of the bartender? So just when you call something like that great.
Well, I think it's, in the end, if it doesn't taste good, all the rest of it is a moot point.
Yeah.
Of course.
So
anything
good.
Food or drink related. But then from there, it's a case of you want a combination of things. I mean, at least for me, you want classics executed perfectly and then something new that's surprising, that's a twist on that, that doesn't try too hard. And they can also do things like Scott did, where you source locally from farmers for your ingredients, your citrus. It's a little bit seasonal without trying too hard to be like trumpeting it. It should just work. It should be a given. And also there may be spirits from distilleries that are nearby. It's like bartending with a brain. It seems like it's as opposed to, I mean, a great Manhattan made with a great whiskey from, you know, if it's from far away as opposed to locally, it's all good. But if you can also kind of take it to the next level, just in terms of something with a twist, I think that helps to make it great.
delight to be given the right to be carefree and gay once again. No longer slinking, respectably drinking like civilized ladies and men.
No longer need we miss a charming scene like this in some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue with someone sharing a delight.
Well, let's lift a glass to Mouthful's guest this evening. We're talking with Scott Beattie, author of Artisanal Cocktails, and a well-known bartender in these parts, and also Scott Hawker of San Francisco Magazine. So let's just talk about who drinks cocktails these days. We're doing that a little bit during the song. So I'm going to guess that there's a difference between who drinks cocktails in San Francisco and who drinks cocktails in Sonoma County, but I could be completely wrong.
I don't know. I was born and raised in San Francisco, and I think the cocktails that I started drinking when I was of drinking age were pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were sort of like shot drinks with silly names that were too sweet, and you know, you drank them because they got
sex
you drunk.
Sex on the beach, perhaps?
Sex on the beach, buttery nipples, whatever they are, you know, those kind of things. And I think when you're 21 years old, and of course I didn't start drinking until I was 21,
of course you didn't.
You're happy just to get a buzz, and you know it's like,
sure,
you know, it does the job. You have a beer on the side, and you know you're with your friends, and ooh, it's fun. But I think over the course of time, I learned that, and the first bar that really taught me this was Absinthe in San Francisco.
And one of my favorite places.
Yeah, an excellent bar. It's been around since I think 98, 99, mm-hmm. And yeah, and it was the one thing I learned there was that great drinks that are sort of in the sour realm. I mean, you have classic cocktails, which might be straight spirits, such as a Manhattan or a Sazerac or whatnot. You might have, you know, dessert drinks also. But in terms of the sort of sour drinks, what you basically have is a base liquor flavor. You have a fresh citrus component, which is usually lemon or lime juice. And then you have a sweetening agent, which might be simple syrup. It might be agave nectar. It might be a liqueur. It could be a variety of things. What that does is it sort of makes your mouth happy.
Mm.
I mean, today I had a barbecue at my house, and I cooked skirt steak with chimichurri sauce. And chimichurri sauce,
that's one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah, lots of vinegar, herbs, all the rest of it. And it melds so well with like a fatty cut of meat, like grilled skirt steak. And it just makes your mouth so happy. That's what a great cocktail does, too, is it everything's balanced. Another thing I learned over time was that you need to measure everything. And you do this for a number of reasons. One's for consistency's sake, especially if you have an army of bartenders working at your restaurant or your group of restaurants. But it's just paramount to everything else. You know, when I see bartenders with jiggers now, I know that they're really concerned about the quality of what they're doing and that they're
well trained. So you're not guessing. You're not doing it intuitively.
No, I think if you're making a gin and tonic, you can eyeball that. But anything that has more than two ingredients, it's really important to measure it all, you know, and that way you will create that balance. You will create that consistency. You can spend hours or days coming up with a recipe, and then once you perfect it, you're talking down to a quarter of an ounce, and your whole staff can do it, and you have that perfect drink every time.
And there are places, bars that have good bar programs, and if you don't have a good staff that's actually bothering to execute it the right way, you're going to have bad. Just because you have a good cocktail program by somebody who made good drinks originating the list, if not everybody's executing it on staff, you can walk in somewhere that's theoretically has good cocktails and have a really bad cocktail.
Yeah. I mean, you might have like a well-known bartender that's sort of associated with a restaurant, but if they don't bother to train all the way down and have every person
Everybody on staff do it,
you could be disappointed very easily. And it does, when you come down to drinks that have multiple ingredients, things really do go down to a quarter of an ounce, which is very difficult to eyeball, even with a boar spout.
Mm-hmm.
So even when we started opening up Cyrus, like I had things in squeeze bottles and I had, you know, pour spouts on everything, and I could do it pretty well. And the woman that, Kelly Sullivan, who was the assistant bar manager at Cyrus for 3 years, her and I knew how to do it. But once she left to be the GM of the Healdsburg Bar and Grill, and I had two new people come in there, I realized that I couldn't, you know, sort of explain to them how to do it. I had to be like, this is the recipe, follow it. Don't stray away from it, you know, and it worked. And I was actually able to leave Cyrus without worrying about it because I had trained these two women for 3 months on how to do it and taught them all the recipes. I met with the kitchen and showed them how to prepare all the ingredients. So I mean, I'd like to think that even though I'm not at Cyrus anymore, the drinks that I spent years creating are still there, and they are as good as when I was there.
So why aren't you at Cyrus?
Honestly?
Yeah.
It was a big job. Uh-huh. You know, it was a lot of pressure, and I kind of gave it my all. And it was.
And you
like,
were also you were one of the point people for Cyrus. You were, I think, the most accessible public face.
Well, if you think about it, Cyrus is this ultimate dining experience, uh-huh. and it is sort of in the back of the building.
Right.
But
so
the bar
it's
is
like,
open to the
oh, there's Scott. I can go in. There's someone I know.
Yeah, and I loved working there, and it was. You were going to say something?
I was going to say, especially if you didn't have a reservation, you wanted to just pop in and get a sampling of the Cyrus experience. I mean, the bar was the face of the restaurant, without
yeah. exactly.
a doubt. Or you sat because the cocktail program was getting so lauded, you would sit at the bar and have a drink before your meal. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, invariably, and you were always there.
Yeah, and you didn't have to do the multi-course, like, extravaganza right. that they do back there. You could order a la carte. And, you know, it was the best 3 years of my life. I have no regrets. I'm still really good friends with Nick and Doug and everybody mm-hmm. there, and I love that restaurant with all my heart. But I think I spent the last 2 years there also writing this book and putting mm-hmm. my all into this book. And, you know, I was just tired.
Sure.
I just needed a break.
Uh-huh.
You know, and once it was very hard for me to let it go, but once I realized that I could train these people how to do the drinks and it could continue, because, I mean, for a lot of people, they might have an appetizer up there, they might just have a cocktail, they're not going to go do the full experience
sure.
because they can't get a reservation or because, you know, they just, you know, it's an experience, you
yes.
know, and they kind of just want to touch on it, you know, they
sure.
might not want to do the whole thing, and, I don't know. It's just time for a break.
Time
there
to
isn't
break.
A. There, I'm not moving on to really doing anything else right mm-hmm. now. I'm doing some cocktail catering. I'm teaching some classes at Relish Cooking School and sometimes mm-hmm. at the CIA. You know, doing some private events. But I'm just now really just enjoying the place that I live in. You know,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I moved up to Healdsburg and I was working so hard I wasn't able to really just sit
right.
down by the river. You know, on a regular basis and just uh-huh. barbecue with friends or do whatever.
Yeah.
And now I'm doing that, and,
uh-huh.
and it's nice.
It's good,
you know?
To live.
Absolutely.
You know, actually, having a life is
yeah.
a nice thing.
And I think
or so I hear.
Absolutely. Well, I think what this book is ultimately about, it's about my kind of experiences working with these interesting ingredients
mm-hmm.
and working with these small farmers and working with artisanal distillers. And I learned a lot of very, like, relevant culinary technique for processing ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
For use in cocktails, so you don't even have to follow the recipes. But if you read the book, you'll learn how to, like, dehydrate fruit slices.
Right, yes.
You'll learn how
absolutely.
To use essential oils to infuse simple syrups. You'll learn how to, you know, use an egg white in a cocktail. You'll learn how to make two wonderful pickling liquids for pickling all kinds of things. And you can...
You'll even learn how to make perfect ice
cubes. Perfect ice cubes, yeah. I mean, it's full of suggestions. It's not really a bunch of rules. It's full of suggestions,
mm-hmm.
and I think that'll be, you know, ultimately what people... will be able to take from for years to come. You know, it's just things that I learned struggling with all of this great produce. And
mm-hmm.
for the people that say that, you know, they don't live in the area and they, you know, they live in New York City or whatnot and they don't have access to this, I think that's changing every year. It's getting better and better. There are more farmers markets. There are better supermarkets like Whole Foods or whatnot. You know, I mean, I think people are getting better access to better
absolutely.
Ingredients more and more and more.
Certainly,
and
certainly on the two coasts.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And also in certain... you know, Midwestern areas, that's also true. One of the things in the book that I really like, you have a section on Meet the Farmers, and you have a section on Meet the Distillers. You actually have pictures of these people, many of the faces that we see, Bert and Mary from, what's the name?
La Bonterre. Yeah.
La Bonterre. I used to serve him at the Brass Ass all the time when I was
good people.
Running that little pub. So it's really nice the way you've personalized those producers.
Well, I'm big into Michael Pollan. Like, uh-huh. I think The Omnivore's Dilemma was the best book I ever read, because I think it forces you to think about, you know, what you're eating,
mm-hmm.
where it comes from, how far it had to travel to get to your plate, you know, who produced it, in what manner, those kinds of things. And I was really getting into this kind of cocktail making at the same time I was starting to read his books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important. I think you should know where your, mm-hmm. your food comes from. And I guess you should, if you can, know where your liquor comes from. Know where your
certainly know where our wines come from.
Absolutely. So why not everything
yeah.
else? You know, I'm not up on a big soapbox about it because
uh-huh.
I realize it's difficult for
no, but
for
it's
people
the
at this
well the way that you've done it, there's just an element of intimacy, which is, I mean, I moved to Sonoma County, and as soon as I got moved in, I started going to farms and going out to the coast and buying milk at the drive-in dairy and, you know, buying eggs from a farm. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah, I'm here. That's how I want to live. That's part of why I moved here.
But it's all, the book is also, because it is all those things, but it also is larded with really good basic cocktail recipes.
Yeah, that's so we haven't even gotten to the recipes.
So
yet.
I mean, that's what's nice. It has all. You can learn a lot about techniques and, you know, using local produce and whatnot. But if you just want to really get Negroni, it's also going to be in there. So it's mm-hmm. it can be for somebody who doesn't want to. Even if you don't have access to these kinds of things, you can still have a great experience with the book.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And some of the, like, one of the things you do is infuse simple syrups mm-hmm. with spices.
Mm-hmm. Which you can go about a couple of different ways. You can use whole ground spices, or you can actually use essential oils.
Right, and those spices, you're not going to get those grown locally.
No, you're not. No.
So that's something that everyone in the country has access to.
Absolutely.
So there's like, you know, the book in a way is very layered. Mm-hmm. You have the local layer, but I don't know, I don't care where you are in the country, you have access to citrus of various kinds. And I like how you teach about how to juice. And you don't actually say, don't go buy bottled lemon juice, but the implication is there.
I think I did say that. No, I said don't buy sweet and sour.
Oh, okay, yes.
If you got a recipe you want to make sweet and sour, this is how you make it.
Yeah.
And it shows you how to make sweet and sour.
Which is great. Yeah. So one of the things I want to talk about recipes, but just before we talk about actual recipes, who drinks cocktails out at bars and restaurants? I mean, just demographically, is everyone drinking cocktails? For a while, it seemed like older people, and then it seemed like real, like way younger people.
Yeah, I think it depends.
Is it country?
San Francisco, I think, especially since the cocktail renaissance, if you want to call it that, that happened a couple of years ago mm-hmm. in restaurants. I think the trick is that people are starting to start, people like the young people in San Francisco, they're definitely drinking cocktails and paying attention to what they're drinking. I mean, you might remember, too, that you go to a bar that doesn't have a good cocktail program, you got to get drunk, like he said.
Sure.
But you go to a restaurant that has a good cocktail program, let's not forget, you're still going to get, not drunk necessarily, you want to you're getting eliciting the response of happiness, but also it's going to taste good. So you get the best of both worlds. But yeah, I mean, I see it at restaurants. Some of the hippest, hottest spots in San Francisco, people are having great cocktails.
And one of the things that I've always liked about cocktails is just the word makes you want to dress up. You know, I don't want to go have a cocktail in a pair of Levi's and a t-shirt, really. I want to put on a cute black dress and some heels, and I want people dressed up around me. And there seemed to be that element in San Francisco
There's a bit of that connotation, but I think it also has surpassed that a little bit, just in the sense of it's become so, I can have a good cocktail and doesn't have to be an experience that's far removed from my normal life.
Mm-hmm.
So experiencing cocktails imbues it with that, which is great. I don't think you should go in, you know, flip-flops or whatever. No.
But I think every day is an opportunity to dress.
Absolutely.
And once you're dressed, it's like, oh, wouldn't a cocktail be nice?
Yes, a cocktail's always nice.
Yes, and also San Francisco has the urban, you know, element where maybe you're taking BART, maybe you're taking a taxi. And I think that's one of the difficulties in Sonoma County is it's really hard to take public transportation. I can't take public transportation to and from Sebastopol to Healdsburg, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a little bit of a barrier, that going out for cocktails, someone else has to be driving, or, you know, there's those elements. Which brings me to recipes and making cocktails at home. So let's talk about that. You wrote this book for people making cocktails at home.
Sure, and also for people that are in the industry that want some interesting sort of ideas for producing new kinds of drinks for their cocktail programs. But as I mentioned before, I think anybody that wants to make drinks at home, buy a jigger. It's like a dollar. You know, it costs nothing. And it makes all the difference for making drinks. It's just like buying
measuring. A jigger is a shot glass.
A jigger is a little shot glass. It's usually a metal thing that's two-sided. They come in different sizes.
Oh, the two-sided. Okay, yeah. You know,
little metal things. But it's the same as buying, you know, measuring cups for baking, or mm-hmm. the little, you know, tablespoon, teaspoon things also. For making drinks, you need to have one of those. And once you have that, and you can sort of get to a better liquor store to get good product, and also if you have access to great produce, you can do anything in this book. Mm-hmm. It's just like following a food recipe. Yes, it will take more time, but I think if you're willing to devote hours to producing, you know, a fantastic meal for your friends or family, you know, and you plan the whole thing out, and you're roasting something in the oven for 3 hours and doing whatnot, if people can put that much attention to making great food at home, you can also do it with cocktails, and I think the rewards are or just as good.
Mm-hmm. Well,
especially a lot of the drinks have elements that you make ahead and you can use them multiple times. It's not
true.
Like you'd spend 3 hours to make one cocktail and then that's it. You can use the simple syrups or the infusions. And
absolutely.
It becomes part of your pantry, like you would have mm-hmm. olive oil or Parmesan. Yeah. And you have the materials at hand to make a really good cocktail.
And the more you do it, the better you get at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's really just, like I said, it's a recipe you follow. And once you learn how to work with all this, you know, new equipment mm-hmm. That you have at home, which is really just a jigger, an empty mixing glass, and what they call it a Boston shaker. It's basically a pint glass with a metal thing that clamps on top mm-hmm. of it. That also will cost you about $2. Once you get used to working with that equipment, like, you can do any of these drinks in this book. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get better and better at it. And, you know, it's fun if you're having a dinner party or whatnot and you start the evening off with something fantastic, you know, not just a yummy cocktail. And I mean, I spent 3 years doing this. Like, there isn't a single drink in here that people didn't really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. You know? And one of the things in the beginning, Winter, the first chapter in the book, as I think it should be, you have something called Hello Cello, which is homemade limoncello. Limoncello got really popular, what, about 3 years ago?
Yeah.
It just seemed to take off. And you can make it at home and give it as Christmas presents.
Well, if you're making some of the drinks in the book, too, you know, you're basically just going to juice all these fruits.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do if you want to make limoncello is peel off the rinds with a potato peeler
mm-hmm.
and buy, you know, basically inexpensive 100-proof vodka. And a week or two later, you're going to have this sort of byproduct. And all you did was buy Smirnoff or Stoli 100-proof vodka, and now you've got presents for everybody. And you get to juice everything and make cocktails out of it. So it's
beautifully efficient.
That's what we did at Cyrus. And, I mean, it was the second year when I realized that we should be doing it, you know.
I should say it's like 8 lemons, a quart of 100-proof vodka, and 2 cups of simple syrup.
Yep. And you know what you can do with the simple syrup is you can infuse it with essential oils or spices
mm-hmm.
and have combinations like lime and ginger limoncello mm-hmm. or grapefruit and bergamot
mm-hmm.
you know limoncello. You know, you can sort of play with flavor combinations that work well in food and translate it into mm-hmm. you know limoncello.
What's a good source, do you think, for essential oils?
LibertyNatural.com.
LibertyNatural.com.
Okay. Yeah. And you would never put essential oils directly into a cocktail. You would take like 2 to 5 drops and mm-hmm. put it in like a quart of simple syrup or agave mm-hmm. nectar or juice or whatnot. They're far too powerful,
mm-hmm.
but they're relatively inexpensive and they go a really long way.
Mm-hmm.
So the place I always got them was from LibertyNatural.com, but a lot of health food stores sell them
uh-huh.
too, you know, like Anstead's and Healdsburg. I used uh-huh. to go there for the spearmint one because they always had it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I brought some back with me when I was in Malaysia. I brought back black pepper essential oil, which
mm-hmm.
is just wonderful. It's
amazing.
I may do something with that in the limoncello arena. So let's talk about some other things you should enjoy at this time of year. Meyer lemons, big in Sonoma County.
Yeah, they're coming in right now.
I got a huge bag. I scored. The guy at the farmer's market gave me this huge bag, and he charged me $2. I was ready to pay like $10 for all these lemons.
Can I have
like
his phone number?
Yeah, right. Seriously.
Yeah, it was. Actually, I have a tip for you. Off air, I have a tip for you. If you need Meyer lemons,
talk later.
We'll
okay.
talk.
Well, I mean, if you were to get Meyer lemons right now, like again, with what I said before, if you had a base liquor flavor, which there's 2 vodkas I think that work very, very well with Meyer lemons, and they're both locally made. One is Domaine Charbet Meyer Lemon Vodka.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is Hanger One Buddha's Hand Citron Vodka.
Yes,
yes. So if you could get either one of those, I like to cut them a little bit with just straight regular vodka because
uh-huh.
they're rather intense, and
mm-hmm.
I think they can dominate a whole drink, so you just want, you know, a hint of it. You could take one of those vodkas and then a sweetening agent. I like elderflower syrup, like D'Arbo elderflower syrup,
mm-hmm.
which is from Austria, is an excellent one. You could also use like Saint Germain liqueur, which is very popular right now. And then, so that's your sweetening agent. And then you would have the acid, which in this case would be Meyer lemons. And once you measure it out, you know, correctly, you've got a perfect drink. And the book also lays out how you can add other things to that cocktail, such as a rim, which has salt. And, you know, with this drink here, it's black salt, granulated sugar, and dried lemon zest. So you have
mm-hmm.
this colorful, interesting rim that sort of wakes up mm-hmm. your mouth before you even take a sip. You can put a foam on top of it. The book shows you how to make foams. Or you could even just add an egg white to the drink, and
mm-hmm.
if you shake it very hard, you'll get a nice head on top.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take it a step further, you can put edible flower petals on top of that head, which is now on the drink, or baked lemon zest. Again, you're using a byproduct from those lemons. You zest off the lemons, cook them in sugar, bake them in the oven a little bit. You know, it's all in the book, but it's, you know, you can decide how far you want to take it. But even if you just do the first step, you've got a great drink.
You know. I wanted to ask you about black salt, because you use a lot of black salt in the book, so talk to me about that.
I just like the color of it. I mean, every different kind of salt has, you know, it comes from a different mineral.
Yeah, because other black salt I have, which is, I think all of mine is from India.
Mm-hmm. That's something different, though. That's the sulfurous.
Yeah, it's very sulfurous.
The black salt he uses is, like, salt that has black mineral traces in it, as opposed to
Because the only
my understanding is it's usually crystallized. It's not
one I use comes from Corsica, which is very crystallized, and then the Hawaiian salt too.
Yeah. Oh, the Hawaiian salt,
a little moister.
Yeah.
You could use either of those. I just like the contrast.
Okay, because I was thinking when I see black salt, I just think that very sulfur. It smells like sulfur. It smells like eggs.
Yeah. I haven't had that
egg
before.
Yolks. I'll get you some.
I don't want it.
Oh no, it's interesting. It's really interesting.
Well, it's not even
you know how they
salt.
Use that?
It's
they,
in like in chaat and stuff. They use it as a seasoning agent.
And you use it in if you make a salt lassi, a yogurt drink.
Oh,
and you season it with that salt, you have a real taste of place. But, I'm glad to know. I hadn't seen any of these other things. It's like, well, that's really interesting, Scott. Let's take a musical break. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. One thing we have to mention about Scott Beattie's new book, Artisanal Cocktails, is the photography. It's really quite striking. There is, on page 124, there is just the most luscious photograph of a pomegranate. And it's interesting. You have pomegranates, as you should, in the chapter on fall. But this one company, Palm Wonderful, has changed the season of pomegranates in California.
Thank you, Oprah Winfrey, I believe.
Really?
Wasn't it 3 years ago she started talking about the benefits of drinking pomegranate juice, and it just
I didn't
changed.
Know, but it sounds about right.
Like overnight.
Well, they...
overnight.
You know, it used to be you would see the very first pomegranates at Andy's Produce in Sebastopol, like within minutes after the light changed, sometime in late August, go to the store the next time, and there would be pomegranates, and you'd see the last ones usually about 5 days before Thanksgiving, and you just hoped that they would hold out so you could have some, you know, because I like them. And that would be the end of pomegranates. And now Palm Wonderful doesn't even start introducing pomegranates until, I think, mid to late October. And they last through, they provide them fresh until January, February. So it's very odd.
Well, I'll tell you, if you can get them right now, pomegranate juice, and let's say you get whole pomegranates and you juice them yourself.
All over right now.
They are. You can freeze that juice. You basically strain it and freeze it, and it holds up really, really well.
You can even freeze, if you have the patience to just separate the arils, the seeds. Mm-hmm. You can freeze plastic bags full of pomegranate arils, and they hold up perfectly.
True.
So anyway, the photography in the book is really gorgeous. I love it.
Yeah, I lucked out with the photographer. Her name was Sarah Remington. She's young. She's like 28 years old, but very, very talented, kind of an up-and-coming photographer.
Yeah, and she does it. There's a real lushness to her images that I liked. But I knew time was going to fly with the two of you, and we're not even drinking. So I wanted to... There's a couple of other things. Scott Hawker, since I have you here, you've got a cover story this month, right?
I do.
San Francisco Magazine. Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's our December issue. It just came out. It is about dessert culture in the Bay Area, and my thesis is that we are lacking in terms of sophisticated desserts. I actually spent a year off and on reporting it. Certainly not all the way through, but I had a million other things going on. But it finally got slated, so it just came out, and it's got portraits of the people I think are worth trumpeting that aren't getting the attention. There's
and who are they? Can you name some?
Sure. There's four people. Two of them we've actually celebrated before. Boris Portnoy, who was at Campton Place in Winterland, and he was recently at Candy Bar. He's no longer there, but there's talk of him maybe having a post at an up-and-coming place, a splashy opening next year in the city. Michelle Polzine at Range, who's been there a while and just kind of old-school desserts done impeccably well with a twist. And then Nicole Krasinski, who was at Rubicon, and she's currently, since Rubicon closed, doesn't have a job, but her and her husband are probably going to open a place if all goes well. And then Luis Villa Velasquez, who's at Orson, kind of on the more, he and Boris are on the more wacky end of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then there's a bunch of other places that I focus on that are doing stuff that's interesting and or worth celebrating. But the piece, yeah, that's a long narrative just about the hows and whys of why dessert culture is behind the times in the Bay Area.
And, you know, in a nutshell, why do you think that is?
I think it's a number of things. I mean, I think it's the fact that we're a little health conscious in the Bay Area. Maybe some people expend those calories on cocktails at first, which is kind of funny. It ties in instead of desserts. That you can kind of, but neighborhood dining is potentially part of the problem. We're known for it in the Bay Area. We don't sit down for a meal that has a full arc, and dessert can be something to go. I also posit that there's biological reasons because there's been studies that have been done that say that sweet is the one innate sense, even though I know, Michelle, you don't really have a sweet tooth, but
there's always those of us, you know.
Yeah, the anomalies.
The end. Yes.
Yeah, but we're born. Everything else, every other kind of taste has to be learned to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And so, sweet, you know, that knee-jerk, easy sweet, like a molten chocolate cake, fulfills that. So you have to just like you have to train yourself to eat sophisticatedly, savory-wise, as opposed to just, you know, a bag of potato chips, which is delicious. But it's just feels like there's much more innovation savory-wise than there is with desserts. Mm-hmm. We're willing to settle for, like, creme brulees. And often technique is bad, too. Mm-hmm. I talk about the economics of the fact that it's so hard to run a restaurant right now, and pastry chefs, economically, it's so difficult. And pastry chefs are often the first to go because mm-hmm. if there's no demand for good desserts, then they'll just make them in-house and have, you know, a crappy peach tart.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I've only had dinner at Cyrus once. During the really, really bad storm on January 3rd of this year, my younger daughter and I went. And it was delightful. We were there, God, close to 5 hours. But Cyrus desserts make you giggle.
I think Suzanne was running the pastry. But I think that is the hardest job in the restaurant business,
absolutely,
is being a pastry chef. I mean, mine is probably the easiest. I mean, here's the first thing. It has alcohol in it. You've been waiting for it all day, and you're going to get a buzz from it. The pastry chef coming on the tail end of, I mean, whether it's a two-course meal or an eight-course meal, like you have at Cyrus.
You have a challenge.
It is so hard.
Well, connections with nostalgia, too, much more than any kind of food. Mm-hmm. You know, you're more willing to be adventurous when it comes to your savory courses than it is your sweets.
Sure. But I thought Cyrus just did this, like, there was this exuberance and almost silliness.
It's kind of whimsical.
That was unexpected, whimsical. And I mean, we giggled several times throughout our meal at Cyrus, and that was just such, it was such a surprise, and it was so incredibly refreshing.
I think a lot of people think it's going to be this very stuffy experience at Cyrus.
Please don't talk too loudly. The customers like to appreciate their food in silence.
It's not like that at all.
Some people have been told that at other well-known Bay Area restaurants north of the Golden Gate, but we'll leave them unnamed for now.
Well, Nick and Doug, they were trying to set up this ultimate dining experience in Sonoma County. That was there for celebrations. It was there for people's birthdays and anniversaries.
The birthday bong.
The birthday bong. I don't know if that's still on the menu, but
it has to be.
I'm not sure if it is.
I'm calling Nick. he can't have gotten rid of the birthday bong. That's like the single best thing I've ever seen in any restaurant ever.
Wow.
Wow.
Do you know it?
Is that they gong something?
No, here, let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
Nick decided that he was just really going to melt my daughter's heart. And she lives, it's not that hard because right now she lives in Mississippi. She too is an English major, and she got a job teaching there. So Nick was just like making her crack up all night. And at one point, when we'd finished the last savory course, he brings over this hand-blown glass dome. And it's this dome on what I guess you could call a small cake plate on a stand. And it's got this little spout that comes up. And connected to the spout is an inflated balloon that is held with a clip, like a hair clip, that's the same color as the balloon. And now inside the dome is this little tiny plate that's holding, I forget if it's 2 or 4 little tiny cookies, chocolate chip. And if you are a keen observer, you look down in the bottom part of the spout, and there's something there. It's not clear glass. It's a flake of something. And so he presents it to her with great ceremony and just says, look at it, and then when you're ready, just remove the clip. So he we're cracking up, and I think it's before we do it, somebody, a waitress comes to the table with little tiny glasses and a little tiny seltzer bottle and fix these little tiny chocolate drinks with seltzer. And so Nicole's ready, and she takes the clip off. And the balloon immediately, of course, deflates, and the air pushes those little flakes up into the top of the dome, which then rain down on top of the warm chocolate chip cookie. It was so... It took your breath away, and I mean, it was just silent for a minute, and then we just started cracking up, and it's like, oh, my God. And Nick walked by, because he'd been not too far away looking. And I said, Nick, what do you call this? And he just looked at me like I was an idiot. I said, the birthday bong. So it's really, I've never seen anything that wonderful in a restaurant. It was just so delightful.
Well, they want people to have fun there, you know.
Yes.
It is like some of the best food you will ever have anywhere, but it's supposed to be, you know, somewhat casual. And you can laugh, you can enjoy yourself.
Yes, and the table next to us kept getting, the people at the table, they just kept getting drunker and drunker and drunker as the night went on. And as they got drunker, they got louder. And instead of being annoying, they just added to the festivity. It was just like, you know, and you knew these people were probably going to go upstairs. They're probably staying at the Mars Hotel. And there was never that, oh, they're going to get thrown at. You know, it was never negative. It was just wonderful. We had such a good time. It's one of the best restaurant experiences I've had anywhere. It was delightful. So do you think you have... So the magazine is just out with a story and desserts.
Yep.
So we don't really know what kind of response we're going to get yet.
Nope.
It'll be interesting to see. Maybe someone's going to throw a pie in your face.
Throw cupcakes at them. Yeah.
That'd be funny. Although the only pie that comes to mind is Anita Bryant getting the pie in the face because of milk. But that's
fruitcake
unrelated.
Could hurt.
Huh? A fruitcake would hurt. Cake. Unless it's a painful. Really well-made, not too old fruitcake.
That's true.
Yeah.
So one last thing. Before I'll tell everybody about how to get your book and that sort of thing and where to find the magazine if they don't already know. But since we're talking about cocktails, absinthe. Next month, absinthe will have been legal in the United States for a year. Thoughts, opinions, preferences, stories? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Do you think it's
I just think it's hilarious that, I mean, although I'm part of the media, but just the way there was so much press about absinthe. Warranted, I mean, it had been a long time since it had been available legally, but it's great. And I love that people are making it domestically. Yeah, it's a delicious drink. And I'm sure it's done a lot for bar sales, for places that have it, which is great. I don't know. There's just something about the fact that it's just been so
It was
kind
fun
of everywhere.
When it first became legal, like, and it got all the press, it was rather expensive. I had to charge something like $20 a shot for the St. George absinthe, which was the first one that was available legally. And locally made, you know, at
Hangar One.
At Hangar at the St. George place, exactly. But I think people are like, ooh, I want to try the absinthe. Mm-hmm. And they come in and I give them a couple of shots and I would tell them how to drink it. And they thought it was like the new vodka or was. And they're just God, this is terrible. You know, and
yeah, people don't even like anise in the United States.
They don't. And they
part,
just.
So it's just hilarious.
Yeah, you have to tell people, like, do you like licorice? Do you like anise? And they go, oh, yeah, yeah. And still, you know, it's very intense, you know. So I don't think it's ever going to become as popular as something like, obviously not vodka, but even gin or whiskey. I mean, it's...
No.
It never will. You know?
Speaking of gin, do you think that there's a... Speaking of new trends, Genever, which is an old-style version of gin, just got... an old version of it got released, and they're making a domestic version of it. Do you think that'll take off?
I think it'll have some success because of the interest in making classic cocktails, and Genever does make some excellent classic cocktails. However, I can't see gin drinkers suddenly switching over to Genever. I don't think that's going to happen because it's a totally different
beast. Yeah, it's a lot more body. And
yeah.
Do you see any cocktail potential with absinthe, or do you think drinking it the classic way is what it is and should be?
It's good with champagne,
Death in the Afternoon.
Oh, tell me.
Ernest Hemingway, it's one of his favorite drinks.
A shot of, splash of absinthe into a glass
Like a mimosa, sort of, but with...
In the same,
But with absinthe. Yeah. They make it with Pernod until it was legal, before it was legal, absinthe. But yeah, it's good.
I think people enjoy the ritual of drinking absinthe, the spoon, you know, the pouring the water over the sugar and all of that, or dripping the water over the sugar. And I think they sort of tap into the old times, you know.
If you were an English major and studied the 19th century, which, you know, I was writing about absinthe before I had any idea what could ever become legal.
Yeah.
And then somebody smuggled a bottle from Japan. So I'd been writing about absinthe for a really long time, but I was surprised it was legalized. I didn't know anyone would go to the trouble to do it. I thought it was pretty interesting.
I've never felt anything different, you know, from drinking absinthe than from drinking other...
You haven't?
No.
I know somebody who... it's a long time ago, so my memory's foggy, but he looked into it, and there was supposedly has some of the same chemical makeup as codeine. And this was somebody who drank heavily. He was in the industry, as I was at the time, and he did some absinthe. And had it before, and he promptly fell over. Well, and it could just be he was really drunk, but he lost his equilibrium.
Oh, he might have, yeah.
But, yeah. I know some people get really affected by it.
The primary effect of absinthe has to do with its alcohol. But there's one secondary effect. And the secondary effect, the chuhone or thuhone, is very similar molecularly to THC. It has one hydrogen bond difference between that. And I find if you drink absinthe on an empty stomach and you pay attention, there is an element, there is a physical element that you can't account for with alcohol. It's a little bit like having velvet underneath your skin. It's very, very tactile and very sensual and very subtle. And there's a very slight elongation of time, an intensification of certain colors in the yellow-green spectrum, which is one of the reasons that a lot of the absinthe posters from the turn of the last century, you would see those colors would be used a lot, and they were very vibrant. Now, that effect of absinthe, if you're not paying attention to it, you're not even going to notice, but if you want to sort of indulge in that and look at it, I find that it's there, and I experience it several times.
Exactly. Don't eat. You know, get some absinthe.
It was the cocktail. It was the aperitif for a cocktail. So what I did the first time, I had the bottle someone brought me. I had it for almost a year before I opened it, and drank it at cocktail time, had a few salted almonds, and just paid attention to the effect. And on that note, gentlemen, thank you so much. We are out of time. The wonderful book. It is a great holiday gift. Give it with a nice bottle of spirits or some homemade simple syrup. Artisanal Cocktail, Scott Beatty, $24.95. It is 10-speed press. You can find San Francisco Magazine on really any newsstand in the Bay Area, any better newsstand, certainly such places as Copperfield's Books. Look for Scott Hawker's byline. Thanks very much to both of you. Hope you have a great end of the year, and I'll see you next year, if not sooner.
Thank you.
Been listening to Mouthful on KRCB. Got another great show coming up next week. It is Raj Patel. Have an intellectual exploration of global food right here on Mouthful, the one country's most delicious hour.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.